Accession number 10037, reel number 3.
We operated from Magui, but that became practically impractical because the Japs could come in and strafe with no warnings. There were no air raid warnings, and they just come in and low level and strafe, and I think the losses would have been so great, aircraft and that. And then there was a great difficulty of getting fuel there because there were no ways of getting fuel there, because fuel was normally would have come up by road. And so anyhow, they decided to withdraw there, and we went on then to Lashio. We went up through Mandalay, and when we got to Mandalay, most of it was on fire, or lots of it was on fire. And also one thing I remember about there, by the roadside, they were selling strawberries, and so we had a food of strawberries in Mandalay, because it's up about 6,000 feet, I think, and the scenery is beautiful. It was, you know, if you were in the right state to enjoy it, it would have been a marvellous trip. And also, the thing which I think upset most of them, the brewery, which was a large brewery at Mandalay, and that was also on fire. But anyway, we went on, and eventually we arrived at Lashio. And here, you see, all the Americans had held honorary ranks as officers in the Chinese Air Force. So, speaking to the padre, he said, well, we'll go and take the lorries round and go into these billets, which I saw then was an officer's transit camp. And I said, well, I can't go in there. I'm only an AC2. He said, oh, well, he says, you're now an honorary member of the AVG. He says, so you have an honorary commission. So I went in and stopped in the officer's mess for 2 or 3 days until he decided and got the necessary paperwork for us to move on farther, because it was great difficulty getting into China then. The British, they weren't allowing any refugees, British refugees, up the Burma Road then, or British troops, because the feeling between China and Britain, I don't think, was very good then, because not long before we'd closed the Burma Road, you see, and no goods were allowed up. And it wasn't until the Japs came into the war that they decided to open it up again.
Yes, why had that? Was it an appeasement gesture
to the Japanese? Yeah, they closed the Burma Road. The Japanese requested, I don't know the political chicanery that went on, but eventually we did close. I think in about 1938 we closed the Burma Road, and it wasn't open. I could see where there'd been, we could see where it had been, it was physically gouged out so that things couldn't go up it. And of course, it had been refilled in.
Yes. So what would have been the point of that? Would it have meant Chiang Kai-shek didn't get the...
Well, he couldn't get any supplies then. He couldn't get any military supplies. They were the only way that they could get... All his ports had been taken by the Japanese in 37 and 38, and his only place of supply was up through the Burma Road. And when that was going, of course, that... The only thing then, he was getting a certain number of supplies down, I believe, from Russia. There were some Russian planes, which I found out afterwards there, because then, because of the communist element in China, there were disagreements there, and so that he wasn't getting anything from Russia then. So they were really... So that what happened was that padre said, well, he said, you will come through as a member of the American volunteer group. So I took my lorry through, and I didn't sign any, or didn't have anything to sign or anything. I just went through with the convoy and took on.
And would that have been your status henceforth? You know, you would have been a member of that group, would you?
Well, I don't think I was officially a member of it. It was nothing very official at all. I was loaned to them unofficially, because their squadron weren't officially allowed to lend me to a group of mercenaries. My So I was only loaned to them unofficially by the RAF. I expect the squadron commander, as a matter of fact, probably said, well, we'll help you out. I'll send one of my radio mechanics over to give you a hand. Mm. So I was detailed to go and do it. But a lot of unofficial things happened. I know, for instance, our squadron commander flew with them on one or two missions, flying an AVG plane, because there weren't any British planes. And that was a very fine pilot he was, who was a Battle of Britain pilot, was our squadron commander.
What was his name?
Gray, Wing Commander Gray. He was our squadron. And he flew a number of times as wingman for the American Volunteers. I don't suppose they know that officially either, but I know he did.
Well, were you at all worried, though, Mr. Jepson, about your, you know, that you could be accused of deserting or anything?
Well, no, that didn't worry me at all, because I didn't desert them, they deserted me. All I knew was when I got back, they'd gone. They didn't even have the decency to send a jeep over to tell me they were going. I expect it was a very rapid withdrawal. I suppose they only were probably given an hour's notice or to say there was a boat there and they were to get out. That's all I can. I've never heard, but all I know, they just they deserted me. I think possibly I should charge them with desertion.
But what was this drive like in these big lorries, you know, into... I think you went to Baoshan next, didn't you?
Yeah, but it was a very hazardous. The roads, I mean, you can't conceive what the roads, they're all made of rock and gravel, and you would see each, apparently, village in China was made responsible for a certain portion of the road. And you would see small children of anything up about seven and onwards sitting around a pile of bricks with hammers, breaking flints, and then you'd get along... often you'd go along for a few miles and you'd find a roadblock by a rock fall, and then you'd have all these Chinese coming out with long poles and shifting it and pushing it over the side, because they were right on the sides of mountains, and there were literally dozens of lorries that had gone over driven by the Chinese. But they would be down, all the Chinese, they'd strip them and they'd take everything that was of any value, and you know, you'd see the old just the chassis laying down there, and you go on up, and then you get all terrible driving up there, because most of the place you couldn't overtake one another, and you'd have little places where you could pull into for other lorries to come down. And the Americans, as a matter of fact, were pretty tough. They were trying to get up quick, and you'd get an old Chinese lorry and he'd stick in the middle of the road and you couldn't get by. And I've seen them pull out a 45 and shoot it at their front mudguards. Of course, they get over very quick then. But, I mean, all kinds of things. And I met one. There were little mud huts on the way where they used to stop to get their, I suppose you'd call them a Chinese cafe, where they'd stop for their rice. And there was one lorry parked there, and there was about 30 or 40 lorries but that behind him, I presume he'd gone in, whether he had or not, but he was holding up about 40 lighter, and the Americans went up, took the brakes off and pushed it over the side so that we could all get a move on. I mean, it was crazy. It was.
Your lorry, would that have been a left-hand drive?
It was a left-hand American, yes, it was a Chevrolet, big square radio truck. And at one part, we had to go through where the road had been hacked out of the side of the mountain, and because of this square truck, I had to get right over. I could only just get through, and of course it wasn't any good having the door open to jump out if anything happened. And I had double wheels on the back, but my wheels were almost over to the left hand side, and I could look down a drop of about 200 feet, and I just scraped through this kind of, it was like a half tunnel through, and there. But the sights were marvellous. I mean, you can't imagine when you come over the top, because the road goes up to over 9,000 feet in places, and you can look down and look right down into the gorges, especially the south. There was the Salween Gorge and the Gotek Gorge, and you could look down. It would probably take you hours to get down there winding. And you could look down and see another lorry just underneath you. He'd be going down, and then you'd zigzag down, and eventually, you know, over the Salween, and then the same up the other side. You know, hairpin bends, and the hairpin bends were so acute you couldn't get round them in one lock. You'd have to back to get round, and to make matters worse, my hydraulic brakes had failed. So I was driving on the handbrake and my gearbox, and I used to go in around these bends, get it in first gear, and then let it gradually drift back, and then let my clutch out in first gear to get away again. And in those days, I knew nothing about hydraulic brakes, because all the cars I'd had in England before the war were only just ordinary cable brakes, you see. So I couldn't do anything for it. I don't know whether I could have done it. It may have been quite something quite simple, but we couldn't get it done. But anyhow, we kept going. And another instance with this lorry, and I forgot to tell you earlier on, we were coming up on the road from Magui towards Mandalay. We were going along quite fast, and my hooter kept blowing. I thought, oh, there's a short in the wiring. But, of course, the road's very bumpy, and we were bumping and bumping and bumping. And all of a sudden, we went over a bump, and I found I'd got the steering wheel in my hand. It come off the top of the steering column. And I put my brakes on, and as luck would have it, I put my brakes on, because we were going moderately fast, 30, which was fast for those. And the lorry just kind of went into the side as though I was steering it, and I jammed my brakes on. And I found that the nut on the top had come off, and that jangling about had what had been short in the hooter, because the hooter was in the separate. So when I put that back on and got that tightened up, it was all right. But of course, it had only just come straight off the docks, you see. So you couldn't. Things like that happened. Mm. And then we went on up through the border, and then the next thing, then we did get a lot of refugees there, a lot of them Chinese, and they went eventually. We got to a place called Poshan, which is the real first walled city that I'd ever experienced. And we parked outside, because you couldn't take lorries inside because of the doorways. They were properly walled. And we went round to the back and found a place, and it was nearer a burial ground, and Chinese, which turned out to be rather fortunate, because they make big mounds and have big tombstones. And eventually, we stopped there for a day, but on the second day, it was one of the worst air raids I'd experienced. The city was crowded with refugees, and was absolutely crowded. And this squadron came over of Japanese fighters and dropped all its bombs right bang in the middle of the city. And it is, well, I'll say, the only time that I have seen, as they say, gutters running with blood. It was terrible. And then they came in strafing. We were fortunate, as I say, we were outside. But we got round the back of the tombstones and things like that as they came in, so which, of course, made very good defences for us. But afterwards, when the next morning, they brought all the bodies out of the city, and they were piled in piles outside Poshan. And about this time, apparently, the British or whoever was down there had asked the Chinese to send as many troops as they could down, and Chinese were going down to actually defend their border. And with their little old Bren gun carriers, which they had, were very, you know, antediluvian, because there was no room, they were actually running over the bodies. It was an appalling sight. Because they couldn't hold up, and it was a shocking, it was terrible. I'd never seen anything like it. Yeah, I will never do again.
Did you get any idea of the sort of help the Chinese were getting from the outside at that time?
Well, the only help they were really getting that I could see were stuff that was had going up the Burma Road. That's all. There was nothing else. The little, and that was, I mean, the sights of that. You would see big flat trucks with two old tyres on them, and you'd have about eight men pulling it, and it would be loaded with stuff. I don't know what the stuff was, and they'd pull these up the Burma Road, and all they had were looked to me like horsehair capes, which they used to put over them, and they would sleep under these trucks, and they'd stop at these little mud, so-called, I suppose, cafes or whatever they were, and eat whatever was there, and then they'd go on pulling these things up. All they had was manual, and they had it. There were some trucks, but of course they were in a pretty bad state of repair, and the Chinese are very ingenious at keeping them going. I've seen a man laying on the mudguard because the pump had gone wrong in the lorry, and with a contrived funnel in the top of the carburetor with a bottle tipping petrol in the top of the carburetor and going up like that. You know, all kinds of tricks they got up to keep these lorries going. They were very ingenious, the Chinese, really.
So, could I ask you, now that we've left Burma, from what you could see at the time, the job the Flying Tigers did for the defence of Burma?
Well, they were the only fighter defence that the Chinese had. And they had, I don't know how many planes I saw, I suppose, in different places because of the numbers, and I came in contact with the planes, about 40 or 50 I saw. And he used to have at Kunming, as a matter of fact, where we operated from there, we did have an air raid warning system, and we had radio stations out at about 70 or 80 miles, about four of them, I think, in the southern part, where the Japanese were likely to come, and they had telephone wires coming into them, you know, crude telephone wires, and they would phone up if there were planes heading our way, and then the planes could get off to attack them. And when I was in Kunming, if one of those went off the air, we didn't know whether it was because it had broken down or whether it had been a patrol, Japanese patrol had infiltrated to it. So we had an old training plane, which was like one, you know, with a kind of greenhouse on the top, but the greenhouse had gone. And we used, on three occasions, I went out with a pilot, he flew the plane, I sat in the back, and we used to go out, and I remember I had a Tommy gun in my lap, that was only the only armament we had, and he used to fly out, and by pre-arrangement, if they were still there, the Chinese, and they'd got a fault, electrical fault, they used to put a certain sign on the roof, so he would circle, and if the sign was there, we would come down, and they usually were near a little airfield, because they didn't take very long, it would be a grass field or a small field, and then we'd go and put it right, and the arrangement was that if the sign wasn't on the roof, of course you would turn in and come back. But I went out on three occasions, and they hadn't been overrun, and put them right.
But I was wondering with Burma, you know, in particular, did they do anything? Did they, for instance, destroy bridges? And
oh yeah, soon after we came over the Salween, they blew it up to stop the Japs. And I think there was another one blown up, but over another one of the gorges, Gotek Gorge, which was blown up. There were only, you know, they weren't enormous bridges. They were strong enough to take lorries and things, but were not like brick-built bridges. They were constructed chiefly of wood, and they blew those up because it would have been very difficult for anybody to got across the gorge, you know, without a bridge.
Did you yourself, you know, regarding the defence of Burma, did you come to any conclusion at the time as to the adequacy?
The inadequacy? It was a shambles. There was nothing in Burma at all. I mean, I felt terribly sorry for the Gloucesters, you know, the chaps there. They had practically nothing. There were a few little Bren gun carriers. And it wasn't that. The Japanese were so ruthless. Well, I mean, you know now. I mean, we knew that they would never take prisoners.
Did you?
Because they hadn't got any supplies. And then they'd got to, if they took prisoners, they'd got to send them all the way down the Malay Peninsula. I mean, it was just, you know, it was in a way demoralising. And one felt so hopeless because I myself knew that there was no possible way that I could get back. And there you were, isolated. You know, receiving no letters. My wife didn't even know where I was for 6 months. And it was only through the good graces of General Chenault, who told me to go down and send a cable via American Express, and charge it on AVG, that I was set a prepaid cable to say that I was safe and well, and then in Kunming, in China. And I got a reply back because I'd sent it pretty. I've still got those cables now that I received, and my wife's got the one she received.
I'd like to ask you now, Mr. Jepson, if you could give me as full an account as possible of what you witnessed of the Flying Tiger's operations in China. And I think this covers both Kunming and Chongqing, doesn't it? So first of all, if I could ask you about the pilots themselves, you know, this group of people, the numbers and the sort of composition of them.
Well, the pilots mainly at Chongqing, I suppose, were about, they varied, but from about between 20 and 30. And they were, some of them were adventurers, some I think had come in for the money, and others, as I say, real for an adventure. And they were a mixed bunch, but some of them were very nice chaps, really. But as I say, like young people between their late 20s and things, and they were dedicated to flying, and they were very good flyers. And they got up to all kinds of things. But to be honest, a lot of them drank a lot. So much so that the padre up there, transport was a great difficulty, and we only had one large station wagon which carried about 14 people. And in the evening, because I was a teetotaler, I didn't drink, and in the end he said to me, well, would I drive the station wagon? And I used to, and he wouldn't, they wouldn't allow anybody else to drive it. And I used to go off at about half past six or seven and take the pilots and those, because they had another hostel the other side. This was at Kunming. And I used to have to go right through the town and pick some up from the other. And it was a kind of a liaison between the two. And I used to drop them off at various places. And several of them had lady friends and had them in flats, or so-called flats in... Yeah. And then I used to go back late at night, about 11. And as I was going over to the other hostel, I used to pull up at these various places, blow my hooter, and then I'd go on and take those that were going back to the hostel and leave them. And then I used to pick the others up as I came back, and half of them would be tiddlers, and their girlfriends waving goodbye to them out of the windows. It was quite an experience. And I used to do that. Well, most nights I did that. I wasn't compelled to, but I hadn't got much else to do. I used to work on the planes or during the day, but it was dark then and you couldn't work on them at night.
They sound quite sort of daredevil type.
Oh, they were. They were. And we had one operator. He was a marvellous wireless operator. His name was Bowman. His nickname was Boogie. And I always remember him because he was a marvellous operator, and they didn't conform to any rules and regulations like I've been used to in the Air Force, and it was really amazing the things they got up to. And Boogie, being such a good operator, they could tell one another's operating by the way they sent messages. And he'd been in the Navy for many years, and he used to talk to operators that were right out in the Midway Islands and all these places when I was in the cabin. And I always remember one he used to talk to from Corregidor, and he used to have a message, and then he used to say, well, I'll give you a call tomorrow. And on one occasion when I was in there, this operator came up and said via Morse that the Japs were only about 100 yards down the road. He says, I don't know whether I should be able to call you in the morning. And I know we never heard from him again. That was at Corregidor. Things like, I mean, of course, all these things, you'd have been on a court-martial if you'd have done that in the RMNC, which I agree was quite right, but they didn't seem to conform to any rules and regulations. On another occasion, they came back in one night about 8 o'clock, I brought them in. I think they'd had a few to drink, and I always remember the armourer, and they stowed it, that we had an old DC-2 transport plane. They started loading it up with 50-pound bombs. And I don't know how many they put in. And off they went. And I understand they went down to Hankow where the shipping was, and they just tipped these 50-pound bombs out the door at the back and then came back again in the middle of the night. They were always doing crazy things like that. You know, that they seemed to be able to do more. like, as they like.
In your opinion, though, and you would have had, you know, people to compare them with, were they good pilots?
Oh, they were marvellous flyers. Oh, yes, they were marvellous. They lived for flying. Some of them had got 2,000 hours flying experience. Some had flown transport. Some had flown, you know, private transports and all kinds of. They were very experienced pilots, all of them, and they were good pilots. But, of course, by our standards, a bit scatty.
You said about the money. They were doing it for the money. Yeah. You know, they sound as if they're sort of mercenaries.
Well, they were mercenaries. I mean, they were, I believe, paid. I heard that they were paid $1,000 a month, but I don't know whether this is right. And they used to get paid $1,000 gold for every plane they shot down. And in fact, later on, there was one ground operator who shot a Japanese plane down. He came in strafing, and he went out of his cabin, and he only had a Tommy gun, and he let rip at it. It was so close, and the plane kind of flagged and then dived into the ground. And all they found on this in this plane was he got one solitary bullet in his head. And so he claimed his $1,000 and got it. But that's a lie. And then another case at Kunming, it was like in all these places, a thieves' market. But what went was our telephone wire from our radio cabin down to our operating theatre, which of course was quite serious, because if you got a radio message in that there were jet planes were coming over, you couldn't get down to the operating room. Well, of course, naturally this was reported, and after a few days, they must have caught, as they said, was a thief, whether it was or not, and they're pretty drastic there. And the next we saw was somebody being pushed along in a rickshaw with a big white thing up his back with all Chinese written down in it, and he was wheeled round and lots of people following and a man in front blowing a bugle, and he was brought up to within about 50 yards of our cabin and they shot him, and all the people ran and dipped pieces of rag in the blood because they think it wards off evil spirits. And then he still stopped there for several days till the smell began to get a bit high and the wind was coming in our direction, and the operators created, you know, and then they came and took him away. But this is how things were. It was nothing to see a body laying around up there.
The planes that they had, were they all these P-40s?
All P-40s, yes, that's all they had.
These were Tomahawks?
Tomahawks, that's right, yes.
And this painting of the planes, you know, did you have anything to do with that?
No, the Chinese did most of the painting. They painted the things on them.
Some of them look like whales rather than tigers.
They're supposed to be tigers, probably. If you are. Yeah, they're supposed to be tigers.
And was it sort of used as an insignia,
used the flying tiger, which was their insignia and badges. And actually, there were 200 of them manufactured. I understand they were designed by Walt Disney, and a special batch of 200 were made and sent to China, and they were presented by Madame Chiang Kai-shek to the pilots, and me, I was presented with one too, so I consider I'm the only Englishman that has one.
Yes, I'm very pleased you showed it to me the other day, and it looks like a Walt Disney tiger.
Yeah, I think it was. That's only the story I heard I was told when I was there that Walt Disney had designed it, and these 200 had been sent out specially.
Do you know if the Chinese themselves were involved in the naming of the flying tiger? Because the tiger's very important to them, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. They may have done it. Possibly in collusion with Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who, of course, all the pilots and that were her idols. They were her personal kind of flight.
Yes,
she made herself responsible for them.
Yes, I must ask you about her and the relations later. But the P-40s, were they up to the job in China?
Well, they seemed to do very well, and the pilots. And, of course, there were special techniques which Chennault had developed over the years, which he trained the pilots in, which seemed to work very well, because he was a very experienced pilot. And I understand he had, in his earlier days, run a flying circus.